Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, we love entertaining at home. Actually, we love home entertainment. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
We're not necessarily so. Well, you're a social creature.
I try to be when I'm not hiding at home.
More of a terrible loner that ended up with a family.
playing with the animals.
I love headphones. Oh, my goodness. Randomness aside at the opening of the show, we love cinema. We love home theater. We love the amazing experience you can have in your very own living room. And we don't care if your living room is viewing at the, well, off of your couch slash bed in your dormitory. If you're pouring concrete for a multi-million dollar home cinema experience, give a big shout out to everybody living in LA that has the dough. We're down with it.
Or here in the Bay Area. Plenty.
There's some money here in the Bay Area.
There's good home theater everywhere. Everywhere I go.
Fortunately, mine's budget, and probably yours is too, but that doesn't really matter, especially if you're a fight fan. Robert, I did not realize you're an even bigger boxing fan than I am, because I still miss Tuesday night at the fights.
I find myself watching more MMA than anything, just because I kind of like that it, still, you know, it's regulated, they're wearing gloves, things like that. I'd like to see like a street version of that where they're a little bloodier maybe, but
come back to 1988 when I was living in New York City. It's a lot less charming when you walk out of the subway and see two guys pounding the snot out of each other.
You know what though? I realized I used to be the kind of person who would try to break that up.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore.
You know, it turns out if you yell police in the right tone of voice, oftentimes the fight will break itself up.
Or people really want to fight and they should have places to do that. And
I think that's a wonderful idea.
I did find a place. Off topic. Driving home from a client's house yesterday, called Real Fight Club, and it was nothing but just like show up and get in the ring. And
first rule of Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. Great book, great movie. If you haven't seen it,
and subsequent interviews too with the author and the guy who did the screenplay
Chuck
for the
Palahniuk.
Movie, they both met and got talking about how in some ways he wished he would have seen that movie and then made some changes to the book based upon the things they did in the movie. It was really cool. Just kind of a mutual appreciation fest going on there. But yeah, you're right. That's one of my favorite Blu-rays.
Chuck Palahniuk's, I hope I'm saying his name correctly.
Palahniuk?
Palahniuk.
Yeah, I think that's
P-A-L-A-H-N-I-U-K. Extraordinary writer. He wrote an essay about assembling, I want to say, freight liners outside of Portland. It's still one of the most amazing things I've ever read. Portland, I think he's from. In any case, we brought up this short-winded aside on violence and men behaving like men because Oscar De La Hoya is going to launch a free boxing channel on the web, which both of us found kind of fascinating. You know, we're watching that glorious period where he'd get all of the movies on Netflix for $8 a month. By the way, that $8 a month price is going away on Netflix. Has been gone for a while. And in one of the things we're seeing as a substitute for that is everybody starting their own, you're a studio? You should start your own streaming channel and then charge people a monthly fee, which is why I own Blu-rays. But the Oscar De La Hoya is going to start a free boxing channel on the web, and Gadget had a nice write-up on it. Quote, ever since he retired from professional boxing, Oscar De La Hoya has turned into one of the most powerful people in the sport. And I was working with Filmon, an internet TV service, and there's going to be two streaming channels launching at the end of January. January has ended. I do not know if the streaming channels are actually up, but essentially one channel is the Golden Boy channel, which is thousands of hours of Oscar De La Hoya, including his fights. And I'm assuming the other channel, the Ring channel, not assuming, I'm reading, will be streaming live boxing from the Golden Boy Promotions Fight Club in Los Angeles for free. So if you miss Tuesday night at the fights from back in the day, you might have a little streaming online something something. So unfortunately, I can't find an actual link to those channels, which were supposed to launch at the end of January.
Where are they?
Wait, two streaming channels?
I'm gearing up myself for another season of MotoGP.
Every time I think I've found another link, it turns out to be another article on like Variety.
You know
man.
What? I will dig it up, and if it exists, we'll include it in the show notes.
Is MotoGP streaming online, or are you still watching it on the television?
No, I only stream it online now. And they're actually doing the free weekend of Sepang, where they do the trials and tests for this coming season. So if you're interested in that and you hear this in time, go check it out. I believe it's MotoGP.com. I could be wrong on that. But they have their own dedicated app and platform, and they've been doing that for a number of years, streaming in 720p. And I believe the quality has even been upped in the last couple of years, just better encoding. I don't think the resolution has gone beyond 720 yet, but it looks great for video streaming services and the ability to go back and watch any race from the previous seasons and things like that, interviews and all that track information. If you really want to get into it, they even have like multiple camera view options and things like that. But I just get the regular season pass for that.
The regular season pass.
That I love. And of course, I keep seeing MLB TV popping up in my feeds just because it's getting closer to baseball season, but not quite yet. It's still early. And it's such a long season anyway, I hate to even bring it up. But that's another one of my favorite streaming sports options, too. It's just MLB TV.
Well, MLB's done an extraordinary job. And actually, I want to say they did. HBO Now was built by MLB's digital streaming arm.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I'm right now also just preparing for the great Super Bowl coming up next weekend. So, or this weekend, technically.
We'll talk about that in a second. We should, you know, it's funny because we were up on Engadget looking at the Oscar De La Hoya article, and they did a really wonderful, I saw a tweet from that this morning, Farewell to the Ziegfeld, one of the last movie palaces. And if you've never had the opportunity to go in one of these old school 50 or 70 year old movie theaters that seats 1,000 people, you're pretty much running out of opportunities in the United States because yet another one has bit the dust. In this case, the Ziegfeld Theater in Manhattan. After 47 years in business, we learned with little warning on January 20th, it would be shut down by the end of the month, being converted into some sort of a dance hall entertainment. But they've got a wonderful set of speakers, you know, and some nice remembrances from Devendra and Chris of Engadget. And it's a really nice discussion because they talk about seeing movies there. I saw had a similar experience when the Star Wars movies were reissued, and sitting in a room, you know, with probably upwards of 1,500 people, every seat in the house was packed. It was the day the movies were released. And what blew my mind was, one, literally a third of the audience was whispering every line to the movie in time with the characters, which was kind of extraordinary. And two, the kid sitting in the seat next to me, I was a kid too at this point, knew all of the new lines, you know, from like Harrison Ford speaking to Jabba the Hutt and everything, which was kind of mind-blowing to me that this kid had memorized the new stuff before the new movie had hit the street. You know, so these were extraordinary buildings, and the architecture is gorgeous, and it's a shame. Like now I want to, you know, figure out a way. There's a beautiful, the Officers Club. There's a Naval Air Station on the west end of the island I live on, and the Officers Club has been converted, but they still have the theater there. Now I want to start showing movies in these ancient theaters that look so glorious and sound so good. At least until the people show up and ruin the whole awesomeness.
Well, I hope more of those classic theaters remain open with quality digital laser projection in 4K or greater.
That's a lot of money,
but I am kind of over film. I grew up in a smaller town as a youth, and our theater never seemed to get any released that week prints. Right. So we got stuff that had been through at least one or two or maybe 10 other projectors first. So by the time we got it, there were a lot of scratches,
a lot of hair.
And occasionally it complete failure and you watch it melt right on the screen. And then you hear the projectionist upstairs madly just doing a quick splice. give me five. I'll have it going.
Sorry, everybody.
But pristine digital quality, after seeing what laser can do in commercial cinema, I understand the desire to preserve 70mm presentations and the machinery to record it with, but
you're still angry about the whole Roadshow release of The Hateful Eight.
That, and there's another director who just announced, "Oh, my movie for 2016 is going to be shot 70mm," and I'll dig that.
It looks awesome.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, there's only like, you know, a handful of places you can still see it.
Give me red epic cameras with 15 plus stops of F and high dynamic range, and I don't know.
No technophobe R. Robert, ladies and gentlemen.
I want it. I love good cinema experiences.
But. So I'm looking at the script earlier today, and one of my coworkers here at the Hack 5 warehouse stops and goes, good strippers save time and improve quality? Excuse me?
Yes. Yes, they do.
And some of you in the audience are staring blankly at your computer or MP3 player, and the rest of you are going, he's talking about wire strippers, you perv.
I really am.
They do, actually. I grew up using diagonal cutters or pocket knives or my teeth to strip wires until one of my closest friends in high school bought me a wire stripper. He was raised by an engineer. I was not. He was raised by an engineer that made extraordinary things. And most wire strippers suck. The kind that are kind of black and flat with little indentations to hold the wire, they cost like $13. They really suck. What you really want is a sort of a wire stripping Ideal makes pretty fantastic wire stripper where it's a clamp and a blade that actually strips the...
Those can be good too.
Yeah.
But I have no problem with the multi-tool style ones that have variable sized holes for the different gauges you're working with.
You know, so many of those I've
used... Once you find the one that works right...
Yeah.
I've used one out of the last six of those. What brand did I buy last? It works fantastic and it cuts through the outer protective sheath without even nicking one of the wires inside once you get your sizing set up the way it's supposed to be for a particular wire type. But just for clean cuts, either the PVC jacket on some of the speaker wire I use, the soft jacket that protects the two conductors inside, for making that look nice and trim, although any knife can make that look fine. But just getting an appropriate amount of wire stripped off the ends without damaging it and to make it easy to twist up and then go from there, whether you're putting it into a banana plug or just, like I said, just giving it a twist or a little bit of tin on the end or whatever your mode is. If you're doing a lot of wiring, it's a lot better. I was using a very fine old school pair of wire strippers that were basically the double chevron shape that kind of come together. And it just requires a very good precise touch. Because a little too much pressure, boom, you're cutting into the conductors. Not enough, and you're struggling to pull the protective outside off.
I mean, there's a couple the ones I particularly like have self-adjusting jaws. Nyko makes one that sells on Amazon. Irwin makes them. Klein Tools make one.
I used to have an old school pair of the kind you're describing as well, back on the ranch, and those work great when they're set up right.
And they're like $20. If I'm in Baja and, I'm not going to be searching through toolboxes to find a wire stripper. Yeah, I'm going to grab it with my teeth and get the truck moving again. But, I also just bought, $250, because I had to buy like 5 50-foot spools of speaker wire. And yes, I will be using a proper wire stripper to strip the cable off of my 12-gauge speaker wire that I just bought. Just because I feel like treating it right.
Totally.
Strange as that might sound.
That it just makes the job easier, especially if you're doing a setup and if you're going to do it more than once in your life, just get the right tool for it and it will make your end result look and perform better.
You use wire strippers more often than you think once you have a pair.
I really do. And yes. I'm now more critical about the wiring I encounter. Say a client had, some damage tip or slight bit of corrosion. And there's enough ample wire left over. You just cut the end off, redo it in a couple of seconds. It looks great. It's done. So, yeah.
Never let it be said that we did not dare to be relaxed, bordering on boring, because we've just discussed, wire strippers, people. We're both pretty excited because of what it meant for distribution. And the possibility of seeing more and more things on places other than broadcast or cable television. Ritter's original title, I want to say, was Netflix Stream Episodes of Better Call Saul the day after they were aired, except it turns out, and I'm going to quote Vanity Fair here, quote, despite tacit confirmation from Better Call Saul star Bob Odenkirk, the Albuquerque Journal mistakenly claimed that Netflix would be airing episodes of the second season of his AMC show the day after they aired in the U.S. It turns out that it is only international markets, i.e. everywhere but the United States.
Well, I might have to make myself appear Canadian for a week or two. That I did enjoy the first season of that show. I found I had a good fun ride with that, and they did stream a lot of that first season for free, for time limited on the AMC website, and the quality was phenomenal. But I think of recently they did require a cable or satellite TV subscription login though in order to continue watching that, which bummed me out a little bit. I'll put up with watching commercials if they stream that content, you know, without requiring at least a paid account for one of the cable or satellite providers. Yeah, I don't even mind if I have to sign up for the AMC website, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I'll watch your commercials. Let me, please. That's all I'm asking. But I hopefully this means then that there's a chance that they're going to bring the other episodes of Better Call Saul at some point.
Well, the first season is on BetterCallSaul.com. Better Call Saul is currently available, season one on Netflix in its entirety.
Good deal.
So you can binge watch your way through the first season.
That's a pretty fun ride. It's not very long. I think it's only like 13 seasons or 13 shows, episodes. So.
Oh my goodness. What's the name of the Reddit forum?
Reddit.com/r/AVXL.
We had a couple questions off there. One near and dear to both the hearts of Robert and myself. UHD BD PC drives ? So essentially what we're talking about here is next generation UHD Blu-ray players are going to be available. We thought in March, possibly as early as February, according to more recent rumors, but expected to ship in March with the first 30 UHD or 4K UHD Blu-ray titles.
Yep.
Pretty good list of those coming together. I'm kind of excited to see that.
Funny thing I heard, a lot of this first round of 4K UHD Blu-ray movies, many of them will feature not all elements that went into that movie were 4K. There could be things like the special effects that were done in 1080p and other little things that, whether or not you want to be a full purist and say, is every aspect of this movie, was it originally recorded or produced from a 4K source? The answer for most of these first titles is going to be no. Chances are the video portion of what you're seeing was, but in certain elements, like specifically we're talking about special effects and other parts of it that might not have been, or they might have been in a couple cases, actual like 2K conversions being upscaled. So that's something I will keep a lookout for and an eye on as we go forward, because this could just be more excuses for, you know, in a year from now, reissuing some of these initial titles as like, you know, the ultra version or whatever you want to call it, with now better sourced extras and other things like that. But I'll be really curious to see how the quality compares with Blu-ray side by side on a couple of the screens I have. So
I'll be also even more curious rather than our reactions, but the reactions to some of our friends and or say spouse creatures.
I'll tell you, sunsets and other crazy high dynamic range scenes done in high HDR on a TV capable of it with the source material that's properly optimized, it looks pretty fantastic. I'm going to say right now. So I'm looking forward to hopefully more and better shiny and bright things.
That would be nice.
TV future. But as far as a PC drive goes.
Oh, boy. I would be shocked if we saw those this year.
I haven't heard a word from anyone, and it used to be you could go to LG or Panasonic, and they were always right there with PC drives. I still roll with an old-school LG Super Combo player that does HD DVD, Blu-ray, CD, DVD, reads all of them and writes to a few of them. And
The newer players do not do HD DVD, but they do read Blu-ray considerably faster. I think there's a couple challenges here. Well, in theory, a lot of the HDMI 2.0 capable GPUs will be software. I think AMD said a lot of them will be software upgradable to HDMI 2.0A, which is going to be necessary for the UHD streaming. You also need software to play the disc. And I don't, given the incredible attrition in the Blu-ray, you know, given that for all intents and purposes, you know, Microsoft has clubbed Windows Media Center to death like a baby seal because we're all going to use our Xbox Ones for stream. Oh, wait, I don't have an Xbox One.
I need a PS4, but my PS3 is still working. So,
but essentially, so much of the Windows Media Center / home theater PC market has been beaten down. Not if you're running Plex or Kodi, but if you're talking about an actual dedicated Windows box, there aren't that many Blu-ray playback titles. In fact, I want to say there's like two, it feels like, at least.
Software? Yeah. Packages? I only know of one at this point, and
one from a legitimate major manufacturer that seems to be sensible.
Still making playback software for PCs. They've all gone away at this point, and there's really the grand poobah that's left. And if you give me a split second, I can actually look up who that is that's still selling the PC software. It's either going to be PowerDVD or the other one I can never think of. The folks who did Total Media Theater.
Yeah, that one's gone.
That's gone.
That's so I think that's one really... I can no longer that I paid money for that I can no longer download a replacement copy. Not that I'm bitter about that. But we bring that up because you know, I don't think anybody other than PowerDVD is likely to do it. And I would be really shocked if the people that own the content are gonna do anything to make this anything less than next to impossible.
PowerDVD 15.
Yeah. I mean, they may come out with it. There may be drives in the works, but I don't think the studios are particularly friendly to PCs touching their beloved Blu-ray discs, Ultra HD Blu-ray discs.
If they can get around, you know, providing software support, and I see no reason the drives can't support it for the PC side. I don't think you're going to see writable media for those new high capacity formats anytime soon. I think you're still going to have support for DVD-R and DVD, you know, plus and dash R, as far as that goes for what we have currently. But I think they'll add playback support in the near term, probably before summertime. But I don't expect
for PCs.
Yeah, sure. I think at least there'll be at least one
this
drive.
Summer.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
Because I mean, if the drives are out now, if the set top boxes are coming out this month for $400. You should be able to get a raw drive, I would imagine, here in the next, you know, before summertime, provided there is software support, because they have the protected pathway, and you're going to need the graphics cards, like you mentioned, that support HDCP 2.2 and HDMI 2.0a if you're going to be trying to, you know, say, power your TV from a computer. So those are known issues, but I'm not waiting for this. That's for sure. I'm looking more in the home environment for 4K Ultra Blu-ray at this point.
Yeah. We also got a question. What DVR after Windows Media Center? Robert, my next DVR will use a capable NAS. Oh, I'm reading your line, your response. Well, it's funny because Windows Media Center is gone in Windows 10.
True.
That said, Windows 8
and 7. Ha.
Well, it's funny, but
for my constantly bugged a computer that's still running Windows 7.
Well, people, you know, if you've never been to it, search for the Windows Lifecycle Fact Sheet, which is up on windows.microsoft.com. And what you'll see is, obviously Windows XP extended support ended in 2014 for normal humans. Windows Vista extended support. When they say mainstream support means they're still kind of actively developing it. Extended support pretty much means they're just trying to keep it from being completely stomped to death by hackers and such. Windows 7 is going to run
through 2020.
January 14th, 2020. Windows 8 is going to run through January 10th, 2023. So if you have a functioning Windows machine, I'm pretty sure the hardware it's on is going to be in trouble long before the extended support ends.
That's why I'm not too concerned with the box I built, now going on 4 years old, for my cable card tuner. It's also my over-the-air reception tuner, and that runs Windows Media Center with their channel guide information being provided and everything. So that I'm in no hurry to change that, but when I go to build a new DVR, or if I were doing it today, I'm looking at, one, you need storage, number one. That's the big deal. No matter what the household size is, you're talking a couple of terabytes to make everyone happy, to record all the shows so you're not constantly deleting stuff. And for everybody who has one of those old school HD DVRs from your, you know, whoever, those things typically have about 500 gigs in them, and that is just nothing but a delete fest with anybody more than two people in a home. It's really, it's unacceptable, but a Kickstarter project from the folks over at Silicon Dust, who do some of my favorite network tuning hardware, including cable card and over the air, have a project where they're going to be doing the DVR Reimagined, they call it. And this is already going at this point. They're drawing in basically their network-connected tuners, or pretty much any tuner hardware that's supported, in addition to NASs that are capable of running the back-end software. Mm-hmm. So you don't need a separate box that you know, yet another device to plug in somewhere and to add to your home and media doings. This would actually be your thing you're probably backing up your pictures and other important data on in the home, and leveraging that to then be the recording mechanism for all the distributed players, and the players can be just software apps on people's TVs or an Apple TV or your mobile device.
Right.
And that I really like, because then it allows easy expansion within the home network. If I want to take content with me, that's going to be simple. Mm-hmm. And it's using a piece of hardware that I think everyone should own at least one of in a home, which is a NAS, a network attached storage device, where you have basically monitored hard drives, where if one fails, the others can hang in there long enough until you can shove another one in. And those are useful devices already. And I like the idea of being able to use that as the main storage place for my recorded content throughout mm-hmm. the home. And then stream that around to all my smart TVs or smart devices and enjoy it that way. But that's really what I've been looking at. And they far and exceeded the Silicon Dust HD Home Run DVR package has really exceeded what they initially thought to do, and it's just mm-hmm. been cruising along. So check out the Silicon Dust website. You can even go back and look up their Kickstarter project on Kickstarter to get an idea of what they're up to. But if I were building my own nowadays, that's the route I would be taking.
That's the route, ladies and
gentlemen. Because there's still no sign that the FCC will enable or force cable or satellite providers to allow their set-top boxes to become software that you could just load as an app on your TV. And that's something, ideally, you know, you wouldn't need a box in your living room. These newer TVs with their CPUs and networking capabilities, there's no reason you couldn't run an app to mimic all the functionality of a set-top box, a DVR from your cable or satellite provider, or just a simple tuner. There's no reason that can't be done today, but other than, you know, they make a lot of money off of rental fees of hardware like cable modems, satellite right. set-top boxes, things like that. That is the moneymaker for a lot of these people. And the last stat I just looked up said that the average cable or satellite subscriber is paying about $230 a year in rental fees. Wow. So, you know, that for some people, that's nothing. But, you know, that's just rental. That's stuff. It's just the hardware to even use their services. And that's why I'm a big fan of where you can buy or build your own.
Why should
do it?
They pay for the hardware when the customers can pay for the
often
hardware.
Often inferior hardware at that. Like mm-hmm. I was saying, limited recording capacity, limited number of tuners for the DVR side of things. And for at least the networking side of things, I prefer owning my own cable modem or right. or whatever, DSL even. That way, it's just I know I've got a fresh piece of hardware that hasn't been tampered with.
Right.
Hopefully. Unless it's the NSA, then we're all screwed. But I've got bigger concerns if that's going on. But anyway, it's also I figure what I paid. I paid about $80-$90 for my cable modem.
Right.
And my rental fee at the time was $9 a month. So that paid for itself in less than a year. However, I will say lately I have been seeing that a lot of the cable and satellite providers are including now free modems. So if you haven't checked your bill in a while, go do that. I got to tell you, they were like, oh, we're not charging customers anymore for the rental on that, even though we've been charging you for the last 6 months. We're not going to tell you that we're not charging anyone anymore, but if you called up and asked, we would have told you that. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Well, I already bought it, so take that off my bill. Done.
Take that off my bill.
But yeah. Specifically for also cable card tuning, where you need all the channels, just like a cable box would provide.
Right.
That's where I hate to even go down the route with cable cards anymore, because they're so limited in some ways in terms of with a cable card set up, you're still not able to access pay-per-view or certain on-demand programming that may be critical to your enjoyment. So there are some trade-offs of doing a cable box by yourself, but if you're dealing with over-the-air reception, that you can replicate on your own with many options at relatively affordable prices too. Although I will say I was just over the hill in Dublin, brand new TV set up with a client, and mm-hmm. just they had a portable antenna sitting there. We hooked it up. There, he was in kind of a bowl of Dublin where just over the hill from the broadcast towers, got like one stinking channel. Whereas where I live on the other side of the hill, 70 channels with modest antenna setups and just crazy. So, yeah, terrain is a big deal with broadcast over-the-air freebies.
Terrain is a big deal. You got a chance to use LG's new OLED mount, the OTW-150. It's a very product-specific mount. Yep. In that it's for 2015 LG OLED televisions. Is it because of the curved designs that makes them so difficult to hang that they need a proprietary, you know, could I use any traditional, you know, could I run to Costco and pick up any of their usual house brand of...
I'd be real careful. I've seen, specifically with OLED, the issue is the thinness of the TV, and the mount typically on these is...
So easy to fracture.
At least on the 2015 models, the mount is relatively low to the back of the TV.
Interesting.
So
it's like right at the base of the television.
So in the case of the EC9300, that first 1080p 55-inch they put out, I think you could use a standard wire-style hanger for the mount. And because it was up higher on the back of the screen.
I'm laughing because, you know, having just hung some pictures in my house, there's no way I'm trusting like an $8,000, no matter how good my wiring technique is or my crimping is, ain't no way I'm hanging it like a, you know.
No, for this, I didn't want to take any chances with a client's brand new. They had their yet another of those beautiful flat 4K OLEDs. Uh-huh. But this mount, about an inch thick, it was about $90 retail. Offered tilt and swivel function in addition to providing a self-leveling function. If you are shopping for a wall mount today for any TV, no matter how careful you are to level that mount on the wall when it's first installed, there is almost always some variance within the bracket itself to where it won't be perfectly level when you're done, and it's just so nice to have an option to turn a quick screw just to nudge it one way or the other and to provide that. And that's what the 150 had in it, the OTW-150 from LG. This also provided a basically four spacers that with total thickness, it was maybe 1.2 inches. With that flat OLED, which is literally pencil thick at the top, when that's mounted and pushed all the way back into its fully retracted, mm-hmm. The whole package might have been 2 inches thick.
Wow.
It was just from the wall to the flat face of the TV. It was maybe 2 inches, and it would just look fantastic. And it had a good swivel and good tilt function as well, fingertip control, where you didn't really have to apply a lot of pressure. Getting it to fully retract was a little bit of a... I ended up not actually touching the TV at all, but kind of reached under and kind of pushed the mount shut with my own hands rather than... it's a curved OLED panel. I didn't want to be stressing it too much. but for pulling it out and adjusting it left, right, and up and down, fingertip control, it was great. And no problem. No problem with that at all. Also, another 2-point grayscale correction on that TV went really well, real smooth. Looked great when it was done. And I'm finding on LG's OLEDs, they're a little green in the brightest grays. The color balance becomes more green the brighter gray gets. So that's the main thing I'm tweaking. And it really does help to correct that, because that's something that's really obvious to the eye when you see, look at skin tones or hair color or anything, especially if it's a bright, solid texture. That little bit of green tinge can really throw you off and make it seem not realistic. And didn't take much to fix it in terms of the adjustments required, but it was good to go through that.
Always good to do that.
Yeah.
You had an interesting experience. Client, contractor, did a great job wiring, pulled everything together. Onkyo 838, Bose speakers, a Sony sub, Samsung 4K TV, kind of a grab bag of components.
Truly. Person had just moved in. They'll probably be replacing some things, mm-hmm. but their general setup was...
Speakers. Replace the speakers.
I looked up the price of these Bose speakers. They were like $400 or $500 a pair for in-wall home theater speaker. It seemed like a lot of money for it. And they sounded okay. I mean, they sounded good.
You know, Bose does a couple of really good noise-canceling headphones, and I think almost everything else they make is staggeringly overpriced for what it is.
This person also was like, oh, I bought the Monster HDMI cables too. And I was just like, so right there, I just had to slow them down a little bit. I'm like, look, generally speaking, with HDMI cables, it's like if it's 20 feet or less, Amazon basics. Unless there's a practical need, maybe for in-wall rated, or I prefer those ultra-thin Redmire cables from Monoprice, just because I pay a little bit extra for those because they're, you know, 3 millimeter thick wires and they're really lightweight and easy to use. So, but otherwise, yeah, this person had a bunch of good gear, and connected to the setup was a game console, a brand new X1 box from Comcast, and they had their Blu-ray player as well. None of this gear was set up right. This person knew the wiring side of it pretty well. They did the construction part. This person had just remodeled their home. That part of it was done pretty well. But when I went to the gear itself, I effectively had to go through kind of everything and start over. And the Blu-ray player wasn't set for bitstream output. Mm-hmm. The cable box to a 4K TV was putting out 720p maximum. So I made sure that was set up for 1080p output in addition to all the other formats. The game console, same thing. We went through and made sure the audio and video were doing effectively max resolution bitstream output. And by the end of it, threw in a Blu-ray movie, went and balanced, did the speaker setup and everything, checked to make sure all the wiring was cool, which it was. After we ran through the setup on that, I put him in the money seat and let him just sit there for a minute, and his face just lit up. And then he whipped out his phone and tried some Bluetooth audio. He was really into that. That's one of his main entertainment ways as well. But just being able to go through someone's gear and say, wow, okay, there was a setting wrong on every piece of stuff here. Mm-hmm. So I was really happy just to be able to go through all that. It didn't take long. I spent maybe 2 hours with this person. But they were so pleased once it was all over. Went over some of the control features of their gear too. It's like, oh, this button on the AV receiver remotes, mm-hmm. what will control your sound relative to whatever you're doing. And in this case, I said, like, when you have a party over and things like that, I would recommend, say, using 7-channel stereo instead of, you know, the pure surround modes and things like that for, you know, Dolby Digital, True HD, whatever, DTS HD, Master Audio. But once it was set up right, and I got to say that Onkyo 838 seems like a solid box. It provided plenty of wattage for this setup and more inputs than he needed, really, but still. Right.
It's better to have too many inputs.
Future proof, and if he wants to do a second zone of audio or something like that down the road, he's ready for it. But it came out, and this was, you know, whole home enjoyment. And the only thing he was missing was maybe a decent universal remote just to make it easier for everyone in the home to use the whole setup. But that's doable.
Brings the whole home theater together.
Bring it together.
We got an email from Tom who says, my brother-in-law Bob is 71. His hearing has deteriorated quite a bit in the last 5 years. He has to set his TV volume at about 80 dB, which is pretty loud in order to hear what's on. Makes everyone else in the house irritated, annoyed, angry, and nearly deaf. Bob hates headphones of any kind, but has no problem using his iPhone earpods for extended periods. Do you know of a device or accessory he can use with earbuds or earpods that will allow him to control the volume for his TV listening only? In other words, if the TV is on, it needs to be anywhere between mute and normal listening volume for the rest of the world while fully adjustable into Bob's earbuds. I used to have an IR device that works similarly, but via its own proprietary headphones. Bluetooth would work too, I suppose. Can you help, Robert? Thanks, Tom. And, you know, we have a rapidly aging population. We have a lot of people. Actually, it's kind of interesting. You know, the boomers are aging quite rapidly. Hearing loss is a fact. Even if you do everything to protect and baby your ears, you continually lose hearing over the course of your life. You know, if you're thinking like, oh, I really need a speaker that has a minimum of 20K extension, I'd prefer something closer to 40. The reality is your hearing, your ability to hear things like a dog whistle, peaks at the age of 8 and then drops pretty much on a scale. You know, that is timed to your age. So, you know, peak hearing is at the age of 8, and then it just goes downhill from there.
You're right? Doomed.
By the time you're in your 40s, you probably can't hear anything much above 13 or 14K. And if you do, you're lucky, or you're at the far end of the bell curve. By the time you get into the 70s, you're talking about fairly serious hearing loss, even if you have taken care of your ears. Now, if you grew up in the 70s or the 60s or the 40s and you spent a bunch of time running chainsaws in your youth and operating tractors and running around banging on things and going to punk rock shows.
Oh, I've got some 90s DJ friends who are all going, what? They're in the what club, yeah.
Say that again?
What?
You know, so what we've seen in the last few years, you know, showing up on the shelves at Costco and everywhere else, you know, one of the first ones I saw was TV ears. And do not mock the TV ears, because if you've ever been in a room with somebody who needed the volume on the television set to 11 in order to hear things, it can be incredibly liberating to have them slap on, some kind of headset that allows them to actually hear what's going on. And also, if Bob Tom, if Bob hasn't been to an audiologist, it's time to get Bob to an audiologist, because they can do extraordinary things these days. My next door neighbor had some hearing loss from his rock and roll youth, but then had an earbud basically rupture on a flight. And, you know, went from, I want to say, 40% loss in both ears to 80% loss in one ear. But the audiologists have done some pretty extraordinary things. And the technology available for hearing aids is extraordinary compared to where it was even a few years ago. So that's one thing to do with
the
Bob.
The challenge is really getting older people to go.
Yeah.
To get those tests. Like my dad could really probably use a good hearing evaluation and some assistance with technology.
Yeah.
Between the ears there and, or not between the ears, not too, but no,
that's a different conversation.
No, but he probably is a prime candidate, but man, there's a person who just does not want to walk into any doctor's office.
Well, it's tough. You know, the nice thing though is if you can get them to get the modern earbuds, in many cases, they actually use Bluetooth technology so that, you know, they can use their phone with their earbuds without removing the earbuds or smothering them. So TV ears is one example that is kind of what you want. A better reviewed product on Amazon is Unisar's DH900 TV listening system or TV listener. And, you know, these look like old school airplane headsets where there's sort of a, you know, it's a wishbone shape and you plug the soft foam tips in your ears. And it's interesting to look because I think what you would ideally want is something that exists in parallel to the audio on there. So that, you know, the Unisar is supposed to do that. They look very, very similar to the it would probably feel, I think, very, very similar to his iPod earbuds. Super Ear Sound app, which looks kind of ridiculous, would be almost exactly what you want. And it's a box that clips onto the belt or sits next to the person, and it has a headbud jack, earbud jack, fantastically well reviewed on Amazon. 550 customer reviews. It's averaging like 4 stars, 74 answered questions. That's a pretty strong sign. But it'll output 107 dB, which is will destroy whatever of Bob's hearing is left. but the idea is that it will amplify the ambient noise or allow you to direct the ambient noise from the television. So you can have sort of like, okay, Bob, you get to sell it. We're going to set the television to this, and then you can turn this thing up as high as you want.
See, that's the challenge. It's like leaving a listening experience for the rest of the room while one person can then have pretty much dynamic control,
that's
loud or as soft as they need it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what, you know, the Super Ear Personal Sound Amplifier is designed to do. The Sennheiser Set 830S, which is a similar product, again, you know, has a cord. You wrap the cord around your, you know, neck. you know, that's only got like a half dozen customer reviews because it's a $180 product, but it's Sennheiser, and they're pretty good with microphones, and essentially allows you to plug whatever earbuds you want into those. It's interesting to look because the ideal thing would be to have like, wow, can I do Bluetooth audio out or an audio jack out from the television running independent of the volume controls on the television? That's actually, most devices are designed, whether it's the headphone jack on a Roku or the headphone jack on an AVR, as soon as you plug the headphone into those, the audio stops everywhere else.
Right.
So,
like I love using a Bluetooth speaker with one of my TVs, and I'll just throw the speaker on my bed or wherever nearby the TV, and because I prefer the sound quality of that. But at the same point, it mutes the TV speakers. It doesn't, I don't think it allows me to use any other Bluetooth audio devices simultaneously, which might be a one relatively simple fix. If you could have multiple Bluetooth devices lit up simultaneously, that would be probably ideal in a way. Because then you could do an external Bluetooth speaker that gives you full volume for enjoyment. Ideally, you could still use the TV speakers and do Bluetooth simultaneously. That would be the simple solution, because then you wouldn't need anything. You could just use the TV speakers, feed that audio to any portable device with Bluetooth audio support, and enjoy both.
I don't think it exists, though.
Yeah, I agree.
If you know of a tool, a solution, a thing that'll make this happen, do us a favor, email us, ask at avxl.com. Mike emailed 4K upgrade path. Robert, love your work on the various tech shows. You're my go-to person on the big picture, no pun intended, of home media. I have a 720p projector in my theater room, came with the house, and a Pioneer HDMI 1.3 AV receiver. I want to upgrade the projector, but I don't want to throw $2,500 at a 1080p projector this year and find out a decent 4K projector is available for $5K next year. Second, I know the AV receiver will have to be upgraded to utilize the 4K, to utilize it for switching 4K sources. Third, I know that 4K source data is limited. Netflix? Yes, by the way, and Amazon Prime and Ultra Blu-ray, UHD Blu-ray in a few weeks. So I guess the questions are, says Mike, I won't ask you to refer to your crystal ball, what 4K sources are there right now? And of those, which ones can feed a 4K projector? How to get sound from the 4K sources to the AV receiver? What component upgrades can future-proof my home theater? I have 60 megabit per second internet to the house. Can you point me to an article that covers this? That would be great. And thanks again for the continual source of info, Mike. So I think, you know, we've talked about it a few times on the show, but Netflix, Amazon Prime, amongst others,
Ultraflix,
MGo. I was gonna say, if you buy a Roku box right now, a Roku 4 will support 4K. And the reason, by the way, everybody, that the latest Apple TV does not support 4K is because A, Apple doesn't have any 4K content, and B, they know the majority of the Apple TV users will happily buy another $100, $150 4K box as soon as they decide to implement 4K. Roku 4, I think, is kind of the go-to choice right now. That'll support the 4K output and has a pretty much, if not all, most of the 4K sources. Ultra Blu-ray or UHD Blu-ray, pardon me, coming in March, unless it shows up early in February, would be the prime source. Getting sound from the 4K sources, the AV receiver, is basically going to happen over HDMI. So yeah, you're going to go from your Roku 4 to the HDMI input on your 4K ready AVR, for example, the 710 from Denon. That'll also give you Dolby Atmos support should you want to get crazy and start bouncing audio off the ceilings. But yeah, you're going to have to replace that Pioneer receiver. You're going to have to replace that projector.
Unless you stick a, you know, our favorite box right in the middle. Right. you haven't even upgraded to a 4K projector yet for Mike. And then
I haven't even upgraded to a 1080p projector. I do think if you are worried about future proofing, I am much more comfortable with spending money to upgrade to 4K than I ever was. Like people being like, I want to get the 3D for my television. And I shouldn't say it like that because everybody, you know, for a while was like 3D, 3D, 3D. And I was always kind of like, eh. But 4K, I think 4K is coming whether everybody likes it or not. So, you know, and even if 4K doesn't come, you're going to end up with a fantastic projector that does 1080p too.
Totally. I guess of all of those devices, I would be looking at the AV receiver first.
Right.
I still wouldn't spend a ton of money on it because I'm still wondering if HDMI 2.0a support is going to be a thing. Is it going to be an issue with the Ultra HD Blu-ray players? It won't be with Samsung specifically because Samsung provides two outputs on theirs, two HDMI ports, one for doing the video audio feed to your TV or whatever,
right,
and a second one that's audio only that then solves the content, video content protection problem. So in the case of having, say, an older AVR that might have HDMI switching or lossless audio format support, you could just run that audio-only feed to the AVR and be cool there. But
we talked about it last week on the show, the Wirecutter's pick for the relatively future-proof 4K AVR, Denon's AVR S710W. That does actually support HDMI 2.0a. It does support HDCP 2.2.
Perfect.
It does have, you know, Odyssey. It does have a 32-bit DSP processor. It should pass through all of the information you need to do 4K, right? So HDR, wide color gamut compatibility, BT.2020 4K Ultra HD video specification. Although they do, you know, on the Denon page, they say key components of the BT.2020 4K Ultra HD video spec. But everything seems to be in place to have a full-on, relatively badass 4K experience for under $500. So
very nice.
I've seen them as low as $350 if you buy a refurbished or open box unit.
And then if you get into the projector side of things, Sony currently offers a handful of awesome 4K projectors that won't totally break the bank. And these are native 4K devices. When I say break the bank, that you at least a couple of good options for under $10,000.
Which is more than Mike wants to spend right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so... If you're holding out for single chip DLP 4K, the first and only one I'm aware of at the moment is that Optoma one we talked about last episode. So.
And that should sell for $3,000.
I'm guessing. I'm thinking it might even quickly go lower than that, and it just become the new. That'll be the new 1080p, where the 1080p pricing I'm finding for 2016 for projectors single chip DLP. I'm finding that 1080p price is now what is basically that performance is migrated down to 720p pricing. 720p pricing is about half of what it was last year, which is great for a lot of people
wants to buy them.
And then hopefully the 4K stuff then will become the new 1080p right. at similar pricing, where, you know, eventually you're gonna have $1,000 4K projectors with single chip RGB LED and things like that.
Yeah, at this point, you know, I would probably sit tight on that. As much as it pains me that you've got a 720p projector, not because I'm a purist, but because 1080p looks so good on a 100-inch screen, you know, I would probably make sure your screen's in good shape, make sure your speakers are in good shape, you know, start eyeballing that AVR upgrade, and then, you know, keep listening to AVXL and keep an eye on Heron Fidelity and watch Tech Thing and everywhere else. And when we see an affordable, badass 4K projector, that sub $3,000 projector you're looking for, we'll be singing it from the rooftops. But at this point, I think you're probably the better part of a year out from an affordable 4K projector, you know, as much as that may pain me. Another Mike writes in, help! How do I know if my 720p TV can handle 4K and Ultra HD? And how can I determine the best resolution for my TV from a Blu-ray player? Is there a test pattern for that?
Short answer, really, with 720p display systems
yeah.
and 4K UHD, I would not recommend spending any money on a 4K UHD Blu-ray player that's coming out later this month
no.
for a 720p TV. There is no point. Why spend $400 on a TV that probably isn't that expensive anyway? So if you already have a Blu-ray player...
That's awesome.
Yeah, just make sure you're using an HDMI cable. Generally speaking, most of the settings within that Blu-ray player should be left at auto, yeah. except I'm for the audio setup, I end up changing things to make sure I'm getting bitstream output if my AVR supports it. But that HDMI connection plus the auto detection capabilities mm-hmm. of the Blu-ray player should provide whatever the best resolution support, input support right. that is available for your TV, which is probably 1080p.
Well,
that 720p probably accepts a 1080p yeah. signal.
The thing that makes it particularly difficult for Mike is that he's got his 720p television is part of that era where instead of sending you actual 720p screens, which are 1280 by 720 pixels, he's got a 1366 by 768.
That's screen. The way all so-called 720p TVs yes. are. Now, there are no 720p TVs that are 1280 by 720.
Oh, they're still doing that.
None of them. I have never seen one.
I've
seen projectors that have.
I actually had a 37-inch 720p
probably
screen.
Probably not. Part of it, too, was because 1366 by 768 gets you just over a million pixels.
Right.
So then you could really do that. Oh, because 720p is in the 900,000 range, I believe. And then so they just wanted that nice round number to say, oh, okay, a million pixels versus 2 million for 1080p.
Well, yeah. part of the issue there... You know, I'm going to brazenly assume that Robert's right because he almost always is. But the problem with putting a 720p output from your Blu-ray player onto that 1366 by 768 screen is it tends to smear the image if it's doing a bad job processing.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we don't know what brand television you have. But if you dig through the manual, which will probably involve downloading the manual off their website, it should give you offers for sort of a per pixel display or a not stretched display. There's so many different horrible.
I mean, the important things really for the TV, if overscan can be disabled,
yeah.
turn that off. And then literally on the Blu-ray player, just leave, make sure it's updated and leave everything at auto.
Right.
That should give you whatever max resolution output from the Blu-ray yeah. player. Because if you did force it to 720p on this 768p screen, technically, you're shooting a lower resolution signal into the TV than the screen right. actually supports.
Well,
I'd rather you shoot something higher resolution into that TV and then have it downgraded slightly to fit the appropriate number of pixels.
You're also assuming the processing on the TV is better than the processing on the Blu-ray player in that situation.
There's a chance that might not be the case.
But. You know, especially if it's, you know, if it's not an LG, a Samsung, a Sony, or another major television manufacturer, you might want to try it both ways, with 1080p coming out of your Blu-ray player and with 720p out of your Blu-ray player. And experiment to see which one looks better. But
I would be tempted to try maybe 1080i or 1080p, or leave it on auto, or maybe 1080i for one obscure reason I could think of that probably doesn't apply to very many people, related to film processing.
But the big thing is figuring out how to turn off overscanning or anything. Seriously. You basically want to end up with a little black stripe at the bottom of your image, at the top of your image, at the left of your image, and the right of your image. And it's going to be 24 pixels on the left and right of the image, and it's going to be...
What are you talking about?
Well, you
shouldn't. I mean, the image should be scaled vertically all the way, or horizontally
to
the very
1366
edges.
Instead of 1280?
Oh, for that.
That's what I'm talking about. Because my problem is some of the smearing.
If you want to do one-to-one pixel mapping on the screen. Okay.
I want one-to-one pixel mapping. Give me my one-to-one pixel mapping, because invariably...
You are a purist. You know what, though? That's why I like 1080p screens.
I've seen some really bad interpolation on 720p screens.
Without a doubt. That can be especially up-converting, lower resolutions. So It's a good challenge, but for a lot of folks, it's the auto modes are very good, including game consoles too. If you're looking at all the video settings, oh, should I have enhanced or full range or something like that? Leave it on auto. It's generally going to do the right thing for the content type. And then check your audio settings to make sure, especially if you're using an AVR or something that can handle any format, make sure you're allowing any format and you're not truncating everything to some like stereo only output. That's the worst. Or in the case of the client I had earlier this week, his cable box, 4K screen, and the cable box was set to 720p maximum output. And you know, it took 2 minutes to change that. So quality for all.
I was going to install that 14 gauge cable in my house, except it is missing in action. Apparently the boys hid it in the backyard or something. So I bought 550-foot reels of Monoprice's Access Series 12 AWG CL2 plenum rated 12 gauge cable.
That's the thickness.
You know, I was all set to go with the math, but then I read a really great article on the Wirecutter that Jeff Morrison and Brent Butterworth did, and they like 12 gauge over 14 gauge. You know, I won't go into you know,
it's pure voodoo.
Speaker cables.
I love both those guys. So.
Yeah. No. Well, what was interesting about the article is essentially.
I'm definitely reading that. So
you have to read. You have to read it because those guys are amazing. But what was interesting is they agreed that different cable could make things sound different. However, the differences were so profoundly subtle. These guys, between the two of them, probably have the best ears of anybody. You know, Brett Butterworth, somebody I ran into long, long time ago, who heavily influenced how I think about, you know, preamplifiers and the audio chain.
He's very practical about his advice too, which I really appreciate.
Yeah,
so. No,
and he's forgotten more about audio than I will ever understand, which is actually flat out terrifying to consider. You know, I was laughing, but I tweeted out a picture of a shit CIS preamplifier. People are like, oh my God, where are the components? And it's like, well, there aren't, you know, there's two inputs. There's a switch between the two inputs.
How is that spelled?
S-C-H-I-I-T.
Gotcha.
you know, but there's this, it's essentially a passive volume controller, a passive preamp.
And nice.
You know, it takes your source and passes it through. If you don't have a high enough line level on the source, you run into issues, but that's a whole nother conversation we'll get into on Audio Geek Day, but here on AVXL. But they both agreed that they liked the sound better off 12 gauge versus 14 gauge wire.
Good deal.
I was like, you know what?
For the difference, you know?
Yeah, for an extra $2 a reel, I'll buy 12 gauge. And then if for some reason, you know, later in life, after I've hit the lottery and I start buying Macintosh or Krell, you know, stupidly overpowered stuff.
I'm going right to the Klipsch website, ordering their most massive reference set, going crazy.
Oh,
crazy.
My goodness.
And then I'll have BMWs in the bedroom and
good speakers.
Everywhere. I'd be a speaker
junkie. I got,
and I will have at least two subwoofers per room.
After my gushing about those ELAC speakers I heard at CES, I got contacted by Kef, and LS50, one of the most amazing speakers I've ever heard, but they sent out their egg speakers, which can work, you know, as stereo speakers, you know, around your television. They can work as desktop.
Oh, cool.
They can take a USB input from your computer.
So a unidirectional sound output, that kind of thing?
No, they're actually a pair of stereo speakers. They kind of like look eggs on stands.
Oh, okay.
But they sound fantastic. They're like near field monitors for your desk.
It's the company that made the really cool like metal ball speakers that had like a flat.
You're thinking of Orb?
Yeah.
Those are the guys down in LA, and those are very similar to, I want to say, a Mark Levinson design was the original one, the first one I saw. The Orb speakers are pretty fantastic.
I like that design.
Man. Now suddenly I'm going into, is that the Lexus ES? No. Wow. Okay, so Mark Levinson is owned by Harman and doing the audio for Lexus's. Who knew? In any case, it was interesting to realize how good these speakers were. It's also really awesome that Kef is pretty honest about their audio ratings, because they, you know, the speakers are down. They rate them as like 80 hertz to, you know, whatever the upside number on that, which is like 27,000 hertz or something crazy like that. You know, but I could still hear, running a 50 hertz signal through it, I could still hear the 50 hertz, but it was down like 6 or 8 dB, so they don't really count that as being a legit low end for it. But fantastic speakers, Bluetooth input, USB input, aptX input. And you can switch between all these sources, which I thought it's interesting to watch these really amazing audio companies, whether you're talking about Kef or you're talking about AudioQuest and so many others that we've seen, where they're taking their technology and accepting that, yeah, you know, people really like Bluetooth streaming. So what can we do to make Bluetooth streamed audio sound better? That's a whole nother conversation. So I am now pulling
A lot has happened in Bluetooth audio to really improve quality. Yeah. And coming up, it'll be Wi-Fi audio, which is the next big leap everyone's going for. And it's just going to get better. Wireless audio transmission with new standards and stuff. We'll put together a good episode for that.
I could use a little less psychoacoustics.
Go over the current state of the art.
Small boxes for Wi-Fi audio, but that's a whole nother conversation.
On the mobile side, you have things like aptX that have just, it is so much better than it used to be. But let's save that for another day.
We could go so deep on that. So yeah, I'm finally going to get to pull that cable through. We watched the last like 3 or 4 episodes of Downton Abbey in one giant binge, which ended at 3:30 on Saturday night or 3:30 on Sunday morning. And of course, my 3-year-old woke up at 6:30.
Popping fresh.
And
my eyes hurt if I do that.
Oh, my whole body hurt.
There ain't enough coffee.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a 36-pound, you know, 40-inch high alarm clock, or 36-inch high alarm clock. But I got to give a shout out. It's on iTunes now. I guess you could kind of call it a horror movie, but it's Henry Rollins in He Never Died. I bought it for $13. If you're a Rollins fan, or if you like weird, crazed, you know, not exactly sci-fi, not exactly Bible. It's good. It's Henry Rollins. If you like really dry humor and a little bit of, you know, blood and mayhem, I'm going to give a shout out to He Never Died, which I really enjoyed. You mentioned earlier, you're in full pre-Super Bowl mode. You made an interesting decision on the output for the 7.1 system in your living room.
Yeah, well, chances are that game's going to be broadcast in Dolby Digital. And in the living room, we have 5.1 set up through an AVR. Mm-hmm. And I find that for general listening, if you're not sitting in the sweet spot, you may as well just flip the AVR into its multi-channel stereo mode, where basically it's taking that stereo, it's taking whatever audio you put into it, and just creating stereo out of it. So each speaker gets a similar amount of volume coming out of it. And it's good for just filling the room. Or I also find it's just a quick and easy way if you're doing late night listening where you can't have the full dynamic range, being able to turn the volume way up and to hear the lowest lows and the highest highs all together. But those 7-channel stereo modes are great, not only for radio listening, because it lets you use all your speakers rather than just, you know, the left right channels up front, but for just general listening. It just makes it easier for everyone in the room. Instead of having just surround effects coming out of the rear surrounds, now we're getting, you know, something similar to what the front speakers are putting out. It makes for a more consistent, even listening environment, especially when the room gets a little loud.
Right.
that, and I'm just testing out everything too, so there are no surprises coming up. And I'm debating if I, weather permitting, I'm going to put a screen out in the backyard for projection. So,
oh, nice.
We do that, but lately it's been wet and cold, and so I'm not sure. We'll see. I'm not risking the hardware for that, but there, anyway.
No. I will, when it gets warmer in most of America, we'll talk about creating a temporary backyard theater and how awesome that can be.
But oh,
yeah. You don't want to do that in monsoon season.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
I love it. I'm also itching for Archer, my favorite animated show on FX. It's coming back for season 7.
Just because it's animated doesn't mean it's for kids.
Oh, no. although if they're young enough and they can't understand what's going on, they'd probably love it. So it is pretty awesome. Season 3 might be the best thing in the world ever. But anyway, those are all available on Netflix, I'm pretty sure. Amazon. I've watched those streaming on both platforms in HD. Season 7, though, they have a trailer out right now that is a scene-for-scene remake of a scene from Magnum P.I. that's supposedly awesome. So I'm going to treat myself to that. I'm still binging on YouTube, and I finally sat down with Grand Theft Auto 5 on my PlayStation.
Really?
And started going through this main story, and I have to say, some of the acting and the storylines are just awesome. Just awesome. And I found myself laughing and commiserating with some of the characters throughout the show. I mean, there's some straight-up evil in there, but there's also some very touching moments of laughter where it was, you know, I'm sure, anyway. Video games are art, and they all support great audio now, and it's just like, oh, just taking advantage of it, running it at 1080p output on my 4K screen. So blah blah blah.
Oh, man,
a little bit of everything this week.
That's a potpourri. A potpourri. Man, yeah, I gotta finish writing up my thoughts on the AudioQuest Nighthawk headphones, which are pretty fantastic.
They look beautiful.
They are beautiful. They sound amazing. They're super comfortable, but we'll talk about that in the next couple of weeks. Got a new set of Kef earphones in for listening.
I still haven't even opened up that one more triple driver earbud that
they had.
I have.
They had the earphones.
Crack those open too.
Yeah, well, they had the earphones that were missing the cable in the box, which actually was a CES thing, not a one more. But we'll talk. We'll get a little headphone activity going on next week. And if you have a question for us, whether we're talking projectors, HDTVs, cabling, mayhem, content, the best way to view things, or your own personal lament at the loss of the glorious Movie Palace experience, we will welcome any and all comments. Or if you just have a hell story about watching a movie in a theater that caused you to realize perhaps you wanted to create your own home entertainment cocoon, we're down with it. Do us a favor, email us ask@avxl.com or tweet @RobertHeron or @PatrickNorton or @AVXL. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week.